We're going to introduce some new concepts today. And it's somewhat heavily laden with Sanskrit terminology. Don't be so concerned about knowing the words as much as the concepts. You know, the beauty of Ayurveda and the beauty of Sanskrit, which is the language of Ayurveda, is that there's some deep resonance between the form and the meaning. And so words like vata, pitta, and kapha, which are now as familiar to you as your own name, don't really have good translations in English. But once you get some understanding of the symbolism that they represent, it has a value that really can't quite be captured in our English language. The language of Western medicine is really Latin. And Latin, of course, came from the Roman Empire, which has a very militaristic view of life and health. So we really think about fighting disease, even the word fighting disease, as a battlefield. And in that process, we have the hospitals aligned in battlefields. We have the chief of staff along lines of command. We have anti-agents, anti-inflammatories, anti-cancer, antimicrobial, anti-ulcer drugs. So there's very much this battlefield mentality, which I think reflects the language that we use. Ayurveda, coming from the Vedic tradition of India, really reflects much more of a harmonizing approach to life. You know, India has never gone outside of its borders to attack a neighboring country. They've been invaded hundreds of times from outsiders, Mughals, Europeans, but there's always within the Vedic tradition been this sense of self-awareness and self-referral. And the language of Sanskrit really very much reflects that. So that as opposed to killing cancer, in Ayurveda the idea is, let's infuse the system with such harmonizing influence that the cancer cannot possibly arise. And so, hearing the Sanskrit words, even if we don't grasp them in their entirety, it still has a value. It begins to change our consciousness. Tony Robbins frequently says that the language that we use doesn't describe reality, it becomes the reality. So if we have an event in the past, we create a story in our minds, and that story becomes the reality. And so the language that we use to describe health, describe life, describe illness, really becomes our model for how we view these steps along the path of life. So let's introduce some of these concepts. According to Ayurveda, there are four goals that each human being needs to fulfill in order to be truly healthy in life. Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. It's a very practical set of goals. The first principle of Dharma is translated as purpose in life. Purpose in life. And according to Ayurveda, every one of us has a purpose in life. We're not here by accident. There's no spare parts in the universe. And so our goal is to really determine what is our purpose in life. Everyone has a unique talent. And when we're expressing our unique talent, we find ourselves serving others, fulfilling our higher purpose in life. Now, we haven't paid that much attention to this when we were being raised or when we raised our children. If we shifted our understanding that every being that manifests on this planet is not an unformed lump of clay which society and family are supposed to mold to fit a certain ideal, but really an incarnated spiritual being that has its own seeds of memory and desire and purpose on life, then the whole shift of society should be towards helping that person, helping that individual, helping that child really discover what is their unique gift to the world, what is their dharma, what is their purpose, and then teaching them the skills that they need to fulfill that purpose. So it's a shift of really what is our dharma, what is our reason for being here. And it requires self-inspection, listening to your inner voice, listening to your heart, and making those choices, which may not seem all that practical at the time, but ultimately is our soul calling us to experience that part of our being which is meant to fulfill its purpose. So finding our dharma is important. How do we know when we're in our dharma? Time stands still. When you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, and your heart is engaged in that task, time just literally flies by. How do you know when you're not in your Dharma? When you're looking at the clock every 5 minutes, and, I can't believe I'm still in this job. So, if you're not in that sense of being in your Dharma, really start asking those questions of yourself, writing about it. What do I really want to be doing with my life? What can I really do that's unique and that I can do it in a way that no one else can do it? And how can I create that so that it's a life for me? The second goal of life is artha, wealth. And there's no apology in Ayurveda for this natural desire that we all have to have material abundance. We can recognize that the material world is maya, and at the same time enjoy the fact that my maya car still runs okay, or my maya house protects me from the rain, or I have enough maya money in my retirement account that I don't have to work until I'm 95 years of age. So if we're in our Dharma, then we will earn money that carries with it good karma. Society will support the value that we're adding. Nature will support the value that we're expressing and ensure that we are provided for. It doesn't mean we have to accumulate hundreds of millions of dollars and hoard it. It means we should have enough to be able to have freedom in the world of name and form. We don't need to apologize for abundance, particularly abundance that's gained through being in our Dharma. And very wealthy people have often said that if you go for the money, you'll probably never get it. If you go for what really makes your heart full, the money will follow. And that's certainly very consistent with the Ayurvedic model. Kama means desire, fulfillment of desire. Sometimes it's also translated as love, as in the Kama Sutra, which are the aphorisms of how to make love in a way that spiritualizes the process. And so again, although there is a select group of people who are renunciates, the clergy, the monks and nuns who completely withdraw from the world because it's their nature, it's their Dharma. For the vast majority of us, certainly most of us who have chosen to take birth in the West, fulfillment of desire is natural, it's healthy. And it means really bringing that level of spirituality into everything that we're doing. Enjoying the meal because we recognize that that food is an expression of consciousness. Enjoying a beautiful movie or a wonderful book because we realize that's another expression of the creative force of consciousness. Enjoying the sensual pleasure of making love because we are sharing spirit with another person. So all these fruits of the flesh are a part of life and should be enjoyed with the consciousness there to always be acknowledging that it's spirit. And then the most important of the four goals is moksha, liberation. Recognizing that we are not skin-encapsulated egos, but are fields of energy and information, fields of intelligence, temporarily consolidating into this physical structure. But we're not time-space events. We are timeless, we are spaceless, we are unbounded, we are eternal. That's who we are. And that when we recognize that, realize that, experience that in every level, every moment of our being, then we are forever liberated from the cycle of pain and suffering. So that ultimately is what being healthy means. It's being in that state of enlightenment. When your doshas are balanced, when your digestive powers are functioning in a balanced way, when your tissues, elimination products are working normally, when your mind, senses and soul are filled with bliss, then you are said to be healthy. It's a little bit different than the definition of Western medicine, which is, Mrs. Jones, I don't find anything wrong on your laboratory studies. So in Ayurveda, health is not the absence of disease. Disease is the absence of health. In our usual model, the lights are off, it's completely dark, you walk into the room and you trip over something. So we crawl around in the dark, feeling, what is this thing? We should move it around. We should dissect it. Move it off to the side. You know, we finally realize through our high technology that we've just tripped over a chair. And the Ayurvedic model is, switch on the light. Then you don't have to trip over the chair anymore. Agni is probably the most important concept in Ayurveda. Agni means digestive power. It comes from the same Sanskrit root that our word ignite comes from. So ignite comes from Agni. And Agni is the power to digest the world. What's interesting is that Agni is actually the first word in the Rig Veda. The Vedas have four major texts, and the first word of the first text is Agni. And it's said that Agni, being the first word of this description of the universe, in its own two syllables, encapsulates, describes, symbolizes the entire creation. So Agni describes that process of the universe manifesting, maintaining for a while, and then dissolving. And that's true for everything that we can think of. It's true for our bodies, it's true for a flower, it's true for an insect, it's true for a corporation, it's true for a planet, it's true for a star. So there's nothing in the universe that doesn't have its lifespan described by Agni. Now, in the human being, the Agni is responsible for translating the packages of energy and information in the environment into the energy and information and biological intelligence of the individual. So Agni is that process of taking the energy and information in the environment and converting it into the energy and information of my body. So it's simple to see it in terms of digestion. You have this spherical, red, sweet object, which we call an apple. What is it? It's a package of energy and information, right? It has all the forces there. It has components of all five elements. So I bring it in, and my Agni start to work on it. They break it down until it's broken down into, according to Western science, you know, carbohydrates, proteins, fats, minerals, trace elements, phytochemicals, etc. And then in Kordi Ayurveda, to space, air, fire, water, and earth. And then my Agnis continue this process of rebuilding those basic blocks into my lungs, my kidneys, my liver, my brain, my energy. So Agni is that ability to take something from the outside and translate it into something that I can use on the inside, and then eliminate whatever I don't really need. Now, as I mentioned yesterday, Agnis don't just apply to the physical layer. It's more than just Anamaya Kosh. Everything that we're taking in from the environment is undergoing a process of digestion through the Agni. So that we can talk about mental Agnis. You know, a new idea. We have to digest it. It doesn't go in right away. We don't immediately, for most of us, don't grasp a completely new idea. We may have to go over it several times. That's the process of our mind digesting the idea, breaking it down into smaller parts, elemental ideas, elemental thoughts, that we can then absorb, and then we reconstitute it into our minds. Our minds are, it's our mental body. It's our manomaya kosha. It's our mental layer. In the same way that we can have toxic food, we can have toxic ideas coming in. And that forms a toxic environment. So if all we eat are double cheeseburgers and junk food, then eventually, because we've been bringing all this junk in, we will overwhelm our Agni's abilities to digest that, and we'll start to store toxicity in the physiology. In the same way, if all we're exposed to are toxic ideas, that will eventually overwhelm our discrimination, our sadhaka pitta, our mental Agni's ability to digest that, and they'll start to be deposited as the substance of our mind. So, you know, Nazi Germany is an example where toxic ideas overwhelmed a culture's ability to digest that. So they carry toxic ideas in their mind as if it was the substance of their mind. And of course, it's prevalent throughout the world. So it's as important that we have strong mental Agnis as it is that we have strong physical Agnis. It's said that if our Agnis are strong, if our Agnis are healthy, we can convert poison into nectar. But if our Agnis are weak, we can actually end up converting nectar into poison. And so this is why Agni is such an essential concept in Ayurveda, because it's actually said that if you have to choose between powerful Agnis or healthy input, you would choose the powerful Agni, because you can convert the poisonous input into nectar. Obviously, we'd love to have both, that what we're taking in is nourishing and purifying and healthy, and our ability to metabolize that, so we don't have to put this strain on it all the time. But raising the level of digestive power is one of the key things that we do in Ayurveda, and that we'll be talking about over subsequent sessions. Now, we've talked now about the doshas in different ways. One is this basic principle of a mind-body function, movement, transformation, structure. Then we've talked about the doshas in terms of the characteristics that a person expresses. So you're expressing a vata nature or a pitta kapha nature. Doshas are also said to be impurities in the system. And they express themselves as excessive mucus or phlegm in the terms of kapha, excessive bile or acid in terms of pitta, and vata is really expressed primarily in terms of excessive movement, excessive thought. Doshas can be seen almost as carrier molecules, that they're carrying information from what we take in. We take in the food, we carry the information, we deposit it into the tissues, we take the tissue excesses, bring it back, and eliminate them. So doshas are continuously exchanging fire, water, earth, air, space, from the food to the tissues to the elimination products. If we can't eliminate some product, that dosha will start to increase. If we take in a lot of that element, the dosha will begin to increase. If we have too little of it in our diet, that dosha will decrease. For some reason, if we're eliminating too much, the dosha will decrease. So the doshas are, in a sense, this carrier concept between what we're taking in and what we're eliminating. And so they need to be in the correct balance. All we need now is bliss in our mind, senses, and soul. And of course we accomplish that by diving into that unlimited reservoir of bliss on a regular basis, which is through meditation. And we accomplish this by seeing the world and seeing all the relationships around us as our mirrors. Ayurveda is very empowering. If you have a problem with a person, that person always pushes your button. And the only way you're going to be happy if that person changes and stops pushing your button, then you have many lifetimes to wait. But if you take the viewpoint that, yes, that person is pushing my button, but it's my button, and I'm wired to have a certain response to that particular button, then it becomes very empowering, because then we can change the way that we react. We can take ourselves out of the fight-or-flight response or the reactionary mode, which Deepak talked about, and begin to move into a restful alertness mode, an intuitive mode, a creative mode, a visionary mode, and ultimately the sacred mode, which is really that reflection that everything that's going on out there is just feeding me back something that's going on inside. So we'll be talking more about all the things we can do to bring bliss into our mind, our senses, and ultimately our soul. It's really kind of amazing how complicated we've tended to make eating in our society. I mean, next to breathing and probably eliminating, it's the most natural thing we can do, and yet we see every week at the Chopra Center people who are so confused and in such turmoil over what to eat that they're making themselves sick. And so we want to reestablish some very basic principles which are so intuitive as to seem obvious, but because we've gotten a lot of different messages along the way, we've lost contact with that very natural impulse to bring in the fruits of the universe into our physiology. So there's some really fun principles about food, which I think will give you an insight in a way that you may not have had before. Ayurveda recognizes six tastes. And if we are certain to have those six tastes in our food, we will be nourished, we will feel satisfied, we will maintain balance. The six tastes are sweet, sour, salty, pungent, bitter, and astringent. Sweet, sour, salty, pungent, bitter, and astringent. You're now experts on doshas and elements. So if we begin to understand what are the elements that comprise the food, we can really very easily and intuitively make choices for the right foods to balance our physiology. According to Ayurveda, taste is the way that nature has packaged potential food in our environment to tell us what is right for us. So if nature wanted us to avoid something, it would make it extremely bitter. If nature wanted us to take more of it, it made it sweet. So you don't have to convince a baby to eat a sweet peach. You may have to convince them to eat some kale. So there's a natural code that nature has provided us so that we could learn what's nourishing and what's not. Long before the RDA and the American Nutritional Council, we had to figure out what we were going to eat. So how do we figure out if it's good for us? We take a little bit on our tongue. If it's really bitter, you think, nah, I'm not going to take very much of that. If it's, that tastes pretty good, that's nature's signal to us that it probably has something in it that's fairly nourishing to us. So let's look at the different elements of the six tastes. Sweet taste is composed of the elements of earth and water. So anything that carries the sweet taste in it will be bringing more earth and water into our body. Therefore, it will increase the quality of kapha. Sour taste has earth and fire in it. So if we take that into our bodies, it will tend to increase both kapha and pitta. Salty taste has the elements of water and fire in it. So if we take more salt, it will increase both kapha and pitta. Pungent taste is fire and air, so it will increase pitta and vata. Bitter taste is air and space, so it will almost exclusively increase vata, which is composed of air and space. And finally, the astringent taste is mixed with air and earth. The net effect of it, actually, is to increase vata and to decrease kapha. So even though it has that earth element in it, which we think would increase kapha, the air element is so much proportionately greater that the net result is that it increases vata and decreases kapha. Now, in Western science, Western biology, we recognize really only four tastes: sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. Pungent and astringent are really more of a reaction on the mucous membrane. So it's less of a taste than it is a sensation in the mouth. But it's very useful to think about these as the six tastes. Now, for each dosha, there are three tastes that predominantly increase it and three tastes that decrease it. So if you want to increase a dosha, you will favor the foods that carry the taste that will increase that dosha, because they're carrying more of those elements that that dosha is composed of. If you want to reduce a dosha, then you will take more foods that are carrying the elements which are opposite in value to that dosha. Kapha and vata, in regards to taste, are almost exactly opposite. So that if you want to decrease vata, you're going to take in more foods that are sweet, sour, and salty. Remember, vata's nature is to be very light and dry and to be rising. So if we want to counterbalance that effect of vata, we want to bring in foods that are heavier, that are warmer, that are moist. And the tastes that carry those elements, earth and water, bringing you down to earth, moistening, overcoming that dry quality of vata, are the sweet, sour, and salty tastes. So if someone is very thin and light and losing weight and having a real active mind, having a person eat more foods which contain the sweet, sour, and salty tastes will help to pacify that vata. On the other hand, if we want to increase vata, we have someone who's very kaphic, slow-moving, heavy, congested, and we want to liven them up, we want to lighten them up, then we're going to use the foods that have the taste in them that are lighter. So the pungent, bitter, and astringent taste will lighten that up. So, three tastes that increase vata: pungent, bitter, and astringent. The three tastes that decrease kapha: sweet, sour, and salty. So, sweet, sour, and salty, they're heavier tastes. They will decrease vata, increase kapha. Pungent, bitter, and astringent, they're lighter tastes. They will increase vata and decrease kapha. So whatever decreases vata increases kapha, and vice versa. So all that's left is pitta. Any taste that carries fire, the fire element in it, will increase pitta. Three tastes carry fire. Pungent, which we know, we talk about. What's another way of talking about a pungent spice? Hot. You know, be careful, it's really hot. Do you mean temperature or do you mean taste? I mean taste. So it's pungent. So that's clearly fiery. If you take enough pungent food, you'll start sweating. So it's hot. Sour and salty are the other hot flavors. So if you want to increase the fire in your body, you have cold hands and feet all the time, you feel trouble expressing yourself, then you increase pungent, sour, and salty foods. If you have too much fire in your system, you have heartburn, indigestion, you get skin rashes, you have inflammatory joints, inflammatory bowel, and inflammatory emotional style, then you'll want to decrease the pungent, sour, and salty foods and increase the sweet, bitter, and astringent taste. Sweet, bitter, and astringent are very pacifying to pitta. It's really quite simple. You have six tastes. Each taste is made up of two elements. We understand the elements, we can predict their effect on the physiology. Let's talk a little bit more deeply about the effects of the taste. Sweet taste is the most nutritious taste that we have. It builds bulk. In fact, if someone ever tasted a human being, the taste of our body is sweet. Our flesh is sweet. And so there's this basic principle that says that like increases like. So if we take more sweet taste into our body will increase in that. So it's nutrifying. It's soothing. If we are upset and we take something sweet, we will be soothed. You know, if your child is going in for a vaccination, they'll be all upset, give them a lollipop, they're soothed. It has that very quieting, nurturing effect on the physiology. It's also softening. So a little bit of softening is good, but if all you take in is sweet taste, you're going to become the Pillsbury Doughboy, very soft. I'm sure by now you've heard, and you expect for me to say, that like everything in life, there's a balance and an imbalanced state. And we'll learn about how too much or too little is not right. We want to have the right amount. So the right amount of sweet taste is valuable. Too much or too little can cause problems. Sour taste is very useful to stimulate the appetite. So particularly for people who have a weak appetite, people who are going through chemotherapy for cancer, are facing AIDS, have eating disorders, a little bit of sour taste, and as we'll learn, associated with a little bit of pungent taste, can really stimulate someone's digestive fire because it gets that fire going. It's like kindling for the digestive fire. It promotes digestion. Again, it stimulates the agni. And it's carminative. A carminative is a herbal terminology which means it helps you to pass wind, helps you to pass gas. So if someone is having problems with a lot of gaseousness, mostly retained gas, where a person gets bloating and gets gas cramps, a little bit of sour taste will help to move that gas out of the system. Salty taste also promotes digestion. It's definitely laxative. You know, the most common salt, of course, that we use is sodium chloride. Magnesium sulfate, which is really the component of milk of magnesia, is laxative. If you take too much sodium, you will get a laxative effect. It's also mildly sedative. It makes you a little bit drowsy. So if you have a lunch with a lot of saltiness in it, you'll find yourself getting kind of drowsy afterwards. The pungent taste also promotes digestion. So a classical herbal formula is to squeeze a little bit of fresh ginger juice with a little bit of lemon juice and a pinch of rock salt. So you can take about half a teaspoon of ginger juice, which you just take ginger root, or you could even just chop up a little fresh ginger. Mix it up with a little bit of fresh squeezed lemon juice and a pinch of rock salt, and you have someone take that about 10 minutes before their meal. And that will stimulate the digestive fire and build up appetite. Pungent taste is diaphoretic, means it makes you sweat. Anyone who's eaten horseradish on fish or bites into a chili pepper will know that you can break out into a sweat. And so it can be used therapeutically to increase the heat in the body and to release toxins through the skin. It also mobilizes excretions. This is an expectorant. So a lot of the Ayurvedic remedies for people with allergies or asthma or going through a cold or bronchitis are to use spicy foods, cloves, cinnamon stick, basil, ginger, pepper, to get the secretions moving. It mobilizes secretion. If you have a cold and you're all congested and you can't breathe, if you take a tea made out of really pungent flavors, like clove and cinnamon and ginger, or if you bite into a fresh piece of ginger, or you eat a real hot radish, or take some chili peppers, you'll see your mucus will flow, you'll open up very quickly. The bitter taste is depleting to the system. It's air and space. So if you're trying to lose weight, increasing your intake of foods with the bitter taste are the way to accomplish that. Bitter taste is primarily carried in green leafy vegetables. So that spinach, chard, kale, and the other green vegetables like broccoli, these are all things that are rich in the bitter taste and help to remove toxicity and to deplete the system. But if someone's already depleted, you have to be careful. If someone is suffering with AIDS and has lost a lot of weight, even though there's often a lot of toxicity associated with that illness, you have to be careful about how much bitter taste, particularly in the form of bitter herbs that you use, because although it will be cleansing, it's also depleting to the system. A great number of medicinal herbs carry the bitter taste and are used to purify the system. A common one is aloe vera, which we know is a topical for burns and cuts. It's also a very beneficial internal medicine using the juice of it, which has a very bitter taste, which cleanses the system. It's depleting to toxicity. Bitter taste is anti-inflammatory. So in Ayurveda, most of the strong herbs that are used for inflammatory conditions, be it rashes, inflammatory joint disease, inflammatory bowel disease, multiple sclerosis, are herbs that are very bitter. Neem, Asadirachta indica, Manjista, these are some of the common Ayurvedic herbs. And they're very similar to the Western herbs like Echinacea or Golden Seal, which are also bitter herbs, which are cleansing to the system and detoxifying to the system. Okay. The astringent taste is that taste that makes you pucker. The common foods that we have that carry the astringent taste are tea, like real black tea. All the lentils and beans and dals, the legumes, are said to be astringent. Cranberries and cranberry juice carry the astringent taste. So a little bit of astringent taste every day is recommended. It reduces sweating. It's compacting to the system. It will cause constipation. The chemical that causes the astringent taste is usually a tannin. And one of the ways the tannins are used is that they bind with the inner molecules of the mucous membranes in the digestive tract. And by binding, they tend to form almost like a chemical bandage so that you end up secreting less fluids, resulting in constipation. It's also this vulnerary. Vulnerary is another herbal expression, which means wound healing. So if someone has wounds, internal or external, taking more astringent taste ends up healing, speeding up the process of the wound healing. Okay, so those are the six basic tastes. Where do they come from? The sweet taste is not just the taste of a candy bar. It's anything that provides true nourishment to the physiology. So it comes from basically proteins, carbohydrates, fats. So sweet taste is bread, pasta, rice. To some degree, the carbohydrate component of beans. All types of meats. Anything that really carries within it carbohydrates, proteins, or fats provide us with the sweet taste. Milk, sweet taste. Cheeses to some degree. Grains. All these are sources of the sweet taste. In any diet, it makes up the bulk of the food that we ingest. If you go to the grocery store and you look at your basket as you're unloading, you'll see that most of what's coming out is the sweet taste. It's either breads or pastas, or if you eat meat, your meat, rice, cereals, sweet fruits, bulk-forming vegetables. These are all carrying the sweet taste in it. The sour taste is primarily derived from organic acids. So citric acid, ascorbic acid, acetic acid, these are all the acids that we take into the body. We get them from primarily citrus fruits and to some degree from fermented foods. So like pickles, vinegar, chutneys, these all carry that sour taste. And it's really valuable. It really makes something delicious to have a little bit of sourness there. It kindles the appetite. It's cleansing to the palate. It gets the digestive enzymes flowing. The salty taste is carried by mineral salts. We mostly get it from sodium chloride, rock salt, sea salt. The pungent taste is carried by essential oils. So anything that's pungent, that gives you that hot sensation, is being carried by some type of essential oil. What's really fascinating is that most of the essential oils turn out to be very powerful antioxidants. So taking in a little bit of red pepper, cayenne, garlic, onion, the spicy foods, they actually provide us with dosages of natural plant antioxidants, so-called phytochemicals. So they should be a part of our meal. The bitter taste is due to alkaloids and glycosides. These are specific chemicals that have a very bitter flavor and are probably reflecting the content of these various phytochemicals, these plant chemicals, of which there are now about 30 different categories, things like flavonoids and genistein. And there's about 17 to 20 of these major categories, and each one of them is now being understood as having a very powerful anti-cancer effect. They can help repair DNA mechanisms. They can help the immune system to be enhanced and to identify potentially cancer-causing genetic mutations. And they're very richly carried in fresh fruits and vegetables. So these alkaloids are really important. The bitter taste is primarily carried in green leafy vegetables and in other green and yellow vegetables. And then finally, the astringent taste, which is due to these tannins, we find in lentils and dals and beans and legumes, as well as in certain substances like tea. Different fruits have a certain amount of astringent taste to them. Up until fairly recently in man's evolution, we received most of our protein from nuts and beans. It's only fairly recently that animal fat has been such a prominent source of protein in our diet. And so the beans and the legumes are a natural way to get the protein that we need at the same time to provide this astringent taste. So those are the basic six tastes, where they come from. And the principle is that we should have all six of them represented at every meal. We'll go into that in more detail. Okay, so We're going to take it a couple levels deeper. Rasa is the first tissue element, the plasma, but it also means taste. So Ayurveda classifies foods according to three levels: rasa or the taste, virya or the potency, and vipak, the post-digestive effect. So rasa we've covered: sweet, sour, salty, pungent, bitter, and astringent. Three of them increase every dosha, three of them decrease every dosha. So rasas we're experts on. The next is virya. And virya really means, what other effect does it have independent of its taste? And there are many ways of classifying it. The most common way is it heating or is it cooling to the system? If it's heating to the system, it will increase pitta. If it's cooling to the system, it will decrease pitta. So foods that are heating are things like chili peppers, garlic, onions, red pepper, black pepper, salsas, cumin, cloves, cinnamon, anything that you put on your mouth and go, whoa, that's a little bit hot. So if it has a hot virya, it will increase pitta. If it has a cooling virya, it will decrease pitta. The other ways that we can talk about foods and predict their effect on our doshas is by whether or not it's oily or dry. Unctuous is another word for oily. Is it oily or dry? If it's oily, it'll tend to increase kapha and pitta to a little degree, and it will tend to decrease vata. If it's very dry, it will tend to increase vata and decrease kapha. So for example, milk, whole milk, is oily. It's a little bit oily. It carries a lot of fat in it. So we would expect that to increase kapha and decrease vata. So dairy is one of the best foods to help people decrease vata, but it's going to aggravate kapha in people who are trying to lose weight. Something like barley is a very dry food. It's a dry grain. So if you take more barley in your system, it's going to decrease kapha and increase vata. So you can think about foods, are they dry or are they oily? You can think about foods, are they heavy or are they light? So cheddar cheese is heavy. Meat is heavy. And if a food is heavy, it's going to increase kapha and decrease vata. Other foods are light. Celery is light. And so if you take more celery into your diet, it will increase vata and decrease kapha. So you can think about it in those terms. So we've talked about now rasa, which is the taste, sweet, sour, salty, pungent, bitter, astringent. Virya, which is its potency. Is it hot or cold? Is it heavy or light? Is it oily or dry? And then we can talk about the third thing, which is, what is its ultimate effect on the system? And that's known as vipak. Vipak. Post-digestive effect. If something's vipak, if its ultimate effect on the body is sweet, it will increase kapha. If something's vipak is sour, it will increase pitta. And if something's vipak is pungent, it will increase vata. There's only three vipaks. Sweet and salty tastes are said to have a final effect on the system of a sweet vipak, meaning they increase kapha in the system. Sour taste has a sour vipak, means its net effect is to increase the acid in the body, increase the pitta. Pungent, bitter, and astringent all have a pungent final effect, which is to increase vata in the system. Now, let me give you a good example of why you should care about this. Fresh ginger has both a sweet and a pungent rasa, meaning when you put it on your mouth, fresh ginger is a little bit sweet and clearly pungent. But it turns out that its net effect on the physiology is to have a sweet vipak, a sweet aftertaste. So it has a sweet and pungent rasa, but its net effect on the system is to have a sweet aftertaste. Therefore, it's okay to use fresh ginger in people who have aggravated pitta. You'd think that, well, I shouldn't use ginger in pittas because that hotness will only increase the pitta. But because its net effect on the system is actually sweet, and we know that sweet pacifies pitta, ginger is okay. Fresh ginger is okay to use in people who have problems with their digestion, but you still are concerned that they have a lot of pitta in their physiology. Another example of how does the virya help us, knowing its potency, whether or not it's hot or cold, is looking at the difference between sugar and honey. Sugar is sweet, and would you predict it, say table sugar, do you think it's cooling or heating? Cooling. You can imagine. Put a little sugar, you'll actually have a cool feeling in your mouth. So sugar is clearly going to be aggravating to kapha. It's sweet and it's cool. It's going to increase the kapha in the physiology. Honey, though, is sweet, but it's actually heating in the system. If you put honey in your mouth, you'll feel it. It makes your mouth warm. So honey, although it has a sweet taste, it has a heating potency. Therefore, honey is okay in people with kapha. In fact, according to Ayurveda, it can actually help you lose weight. If you're going to use a sweetener when you're trying to lose weight, honey is the one to use it. But you want to reduce some of the honey in people who have a strong pitta nature, because it'll actually heat them up a little bit more. So this is where having a little bit deeper understanding of the influence of these foods can allow you to fine-tune some of your dietary recommendations for people. Now, how do we know this stuff? Well, the way that we know it is in our own awareness. So you can test out everything that the Ayurvedic sages 5,000 or 6,000 years ago told us. And when you look into some of the traditional Ayurvedic books, you'll see that every single food is categorized according to its rasa, its virya, and its vipak. You can trust them, or you can test it out for yourself. But you will notice that the foods that have the three tastes that increase kapha will have a kapha increasing effect on your physiology. You'll notice that foods that are heating will increase your pitta, foods that are cooling will decrease your pitta. And if you learn that certain foods have this after effect, you'll also notice that down the road, they have a net effect of either increasing vata, pitta, or kapha on your physiology. The good news is you don't have to worry about this very much, for a couple of reasons. One is that if you eat a balanced diet, you will satisfy your body's needs for balanced nutrition. And if you listen to your body carefully, your body will tell you exactly what it needs to achieve that balance. Now, in your syllabus, you have recommendations for each of these diets. And we hand out similar sheets to all of our patients, which is basically listing the foods that fit the criteria that will either increase or decrease the dosha that you're trying to work with. So we won't go over these in terrible detail, but just what do you want to do to balance vata? You want to have foods that are warmer, heavier, oilier, and have more of the sweet, sour, and salty taste. So what are those foods? First, of course, vatas can eat more. They tend to be light and thin. It's good for vatas to have a little bit more bulk. Dairy products are very good for pacifying vata. Sweeteners, fats and oils, the heavier wheats, the heavier grains. Rice and wheat are the best. Some of these other grains are said to be lighter. Heavier fruits, the rich, sweet, moist fruits. Almost all the vegetables work fine for you. Spices are the warmer spices. Again, vata tends to be cold and cooling. So lots of spices, warm spices are good. Nuts are fine. Beans tend to produce gas. Gas is a reflection of vata. So the beans that are easier to digest, like tofu, mung beans, these are ones that are recommended. And then the lighter meats. So vata. Pitta, primarily we're going to favor foods that are cool and carry the sweet, bitter, and astringent flavors. You're going to use less fermented foods, less things like aged cheeses and yogurts, because they're all carrying that sour taste. Sweeteners are fine, except you want to reduce honey. Molasses also carries more of that hot quality to it. Oils are good, some are more cooling than others. Most grains are fine. Sweeter fruits. If they get to be too sour, they're going to increase the pitta. So berries, particularly things like strawberries, if they're not really ripe and fresh, they'll tend to increase pitta. Lots of people get rashes when they eat strawberries because that pitta gets aggravated. Vegetables, for the most part, are good. Less of the real sour vegetables like tomatoes. Less of the hot peppers. Spices, generally more cooling. And then again, kapha. You don't want to eat lighter, drier, warmer foods. Dairy's okay, but it should be lower fat. Fruits, not so many heavy, rich fruits, particularly things like bananas, which are really kapha aggravating. Honey is okay. Beans are good. Beans lighten. So protein sources for people who are trying to lose weight, balance their kapha. Legumes, lentils, dals, mung beans, these are really good. Lighter grains. Nuts are pretty rich in fats, carbohydrates, so you want to reduce the nuts. Seeds are okay. Things like sunflower seeds are better. They're less kapha aggravating. Spices are really good. You want to spice up a kapha. So hot, spicy things that get their circulation going, get their digestion going. These are of great value to kaphas, except for salt, which increases kapha. Now, the real principle is not to get fanatical about it. Food is a celebration. Eating should be fun. It should be joyful. It's a sacrament. Here we have this amazing gift of nature that we have the opportunity to not only convert into who we are, but to enjoy the process. Think if eating food was as enjoyable as filling up your car with gas. And it would be such a drag. Oh, God, I got to eat today. I'm going to run out of fuel. Nature packaged it to make it wonderful and enjoyable. So eating is good. And eating in balance, eating in a balanced way is good. It means we should have everything available, but in a certain level of moderation. How we eat is more important than what we eat. Or how we eat is at least as important as what we eat. And this is where we offer these Ayurvedic principles, which we call the body intelligent techniques, or BITs. Sometimes we call them the eating awareness techniques, or the EATs. These techniques allow for your agnis to be healthy, so that whatever you're eating, by eating with awareness, you can make certain that you're extracting the maximal nourishment from what you're taking into your system. So we'll go over them. The first principle is to always eat in a settled environment. That means it doesn't do you a lot of good to be eating while you're watching Terminator 2 on television. Or at your office when you're on the phone with one thing, you're typing on your computer with the other thing. It's not very good to eat while you're driving on the highway. Because that chaos and that turbulence in your life is generating chaotic and turbulent neurochemicals. And so that's going to get intermingled with all the neurochemistry and all the biochemistry that you're taking into your physiology. So again, eating should be seen as a celebration, and that means reduce the level of chaos, structure the time for yourself to eat. So it's much better to take 10 minutes, turn off the phone, close the door, and eat than it is to eat for an hour while people are running in and out of your office, phone is ringing, and you're in this constant high-pitched state of anxiety. Similarly, don't eat when you're upset. It may seem that that piece of strawberry cheesecake is just the right thing to eat after you've just had a fight with your boyfriend or your girlfriend or your spouse. But again, there's a turbulence there that food will not be appropriately metabolized. We will not satisfy an emotional need with food. Temporarily, it may feel good to have this sense of some fullness in our body, but it won't satisfy the emotional need, and it will begin to create a level of toxicity in our physiology. So settle the emotional issue on the emotional level, and then when your digestion and your appetite is telling you it's time to eat, that's the time to eat. Always sit down to eat. It's the way that we are programmed. You know, horses can eat standing up, dogs can eat standing up. Human beings actually digest the best. You remove the strain on your system and allow the attention of your body and the blood supply to go to your digestive tract. Eat only when hungry. What a concept, huh? You know, we've gotten a lot of very unhealthy messages. along the way. Most of us got at least two of them. One of the messages that we all got was, eat everything on your plate, there are children starving in India. Now, Deepak tells me that in his family, his mom would say, eat everything on your plate, there are children starving in China. And in Hong Kong, they say, eat everything on your plate, there are children starving in New York City. So, from a very early age, we're taught that we should override our internal signals. So, we're full. Maybe we still have a little bit room in our dessert slot. But we're full, but you're not leaving the table until you finish everything there. You know, you're wasting food. Of course, we all wondered how it is that me eating this is going to help those kids in India. But we were taught really quite young to not listen to what our body is telling us. So from that point on, we just stopped listening. Getting back in tune with our appetite is the healthiest thing we can do. People envision their appetite as like this monster that, left unchecked, will devour the entire refrigerator. And it's because we haven't learned to really listen to it in a conscious way. We like to think of the appetite as a very clear signal from our body as to what is necessary. It's like the fuel gauge. So we recommend thinking about your appetite as a gauge from 0 to 10, like the gauge on your car, where 10 is totally full and stuffed and 0 is completely empty. Very few Americans have ever been at 0, where you've gone for a couple days and you're literally starting to digest your body. Almost every American on Thanksgiving or Christmas or other holiday has been at a 10, where you are so full you have to unbutton your pants and all you can do is kind of roll over to the sofa. The recommendation is that you get in touch with your body and you find out where you are on that scale. When you're at about a level of a 2 or maybe a 3 is the time to eat. 2 or 3 means you're hungry. You're thinking about food. You know, if you're driving, every time you go by a food store, you're thinking, yeah, maybe I should stop off and get something. You are good and hungry. You're not in pain yet. When you're at a 1, you're actually having hunger cramps. But you're really quite hungry. That's the time to eat. And then you eat until you're at about at a 7. And a 7 means you're satisfied. You're comfortable. Yes, you could pour in another couple handfuls of food. But if you stopped eating at that point, you wouldn't have to think about food for a while. Ayurveda says 2 handfuls is the right amount to get you to a 7. 2 handfuls of your plate. Now, why do we bypass that? Most of the time, because we're totally not paying attention. We eat either until everything's gone on our plate, or we're so involved in conversation and thinking about a million other things that we get to a 10, and then we think, God, why did I eat that last helping of mashed potatoes? So paying conscious awareness while eating will allow you to stay in touch with what your body's telling you. How do you do it? Let's do it right now. Close your eyes. Put one of your hands on your belly. And just ask the question, where am I on the scale? Am I at a 0 or a 1 where I'm totally empty? Am I at a 10? Am I somewhere in between? So just note it. And then maybe in about 10 minutes or 15 minutes, note it again. And you'll see that that gauge is reflecting your current appetite. Now, sometimes in your car, this happens in my car, you fill it up, you get in the car and it's still on empty because it takes a while for the gauge to catch up with what's happening. But if you take your time and you pace your eating, your gauge will be right in tune with that. How many people have noticed that at times you're still hungry at the end of the meal? So you order something, or you say, oh, I think I'll have another helping of pasta, but you haven't made enough, so you throw some more pasta in. But by the time it's ready, you're actually satisfied because your awareness has finally caught up with what your body is telling you. Then, of course, you eat it anyways because you went through all the trouble of making it. But I'd like to encourage you with the thought that wasting food is putting food into your body that you don't really need at that point. It's much more wasteful to stuff another helping into your body than it is to throw it away, give it to your dog, or pack it up and find somebody who needs it, some homeless person who needs it, and give it to them. So stuffing into your body when you don't really need it is wasting food. eat only when hungry. The other message that we got a lot was, my mom was really good at this. She used to say, what do you think I'm running here, a restaurant? Which is referring to the idea that sometimes I wasn't hungry when the dinner was ready. So most of us got this information, and certainly as a parent, I know you can't be cooking for your kids 24 hours a day. But sometimes you're not hungry. How many people believe the message that breakfast is the most important meal of the day? Okay. Well, most people believe that message. It's still constantly being heard, particularly by manufacturers of frozen waffles. But a lot of people aren't hungry first thing in the morning. And that for them to eat a breakfast at that time is putting food in when they don't really need it. So some people do, particularly pittas. They tend to be quite hungry and they can eat a full breakfast. But a vata may not need much first thing in the morning. It may not be until 9 or 10 or 11 in the morning that you need something. A kapha the same way. They may have a slow digestion. So rather than following these external rules, that there was a lot of reasons, often political or economic, that we were given those rules, listen to your body. Your body is the best doctor. Your body is the best healer. Avoid ice-cold food and drinks. Part of the reason I think that this came into the Ayurvedic thinking is that there weren't a lot of automatic ice makers 5,000 years ago. But part of it is that our body functions best at body temperature. That all of the enzymes, the gastrin, hydrochloric acid, the pancreatic enzymes, bile acids, they all work very well at 98.6. That's the temperature that they evolved in. And so if we end up eating a lot of cold foods while we're trying to digest, we're probably not optimizing the digestive process. Cold also has the effect of numbing our taste buds. And in Ayurveda, the taste of something automatically begins sending messages to the nervous system about what's coming into our physiology. And so if we eat something that's really ice cold, often we completely numb up our ability to taste it, which is why there's certain foods that if you ate warm, you probably wouldn't want, like drinking a warm Coca-Cola or drinking a warm beer. I know in England they do drink warm beers, but for the most part, the foods that aren't that nourishing, we tend to make really icy so we can sneak them past us. Sneak them past the taste buds. Now that doesn't mean that you can't eat ice cream. I love ice cream and frozen yogurt. It just means when you're going to eat it at the time that your digestive power is the strongest. And as we'll learn, that tends to be around the noontime hour. So when we go into daily routine, one of the things we'll emphasize is there's a time to eat, and the best time to eat your big meal is really at noontime. Don't talk while chewing your food. It's obnoxious, right? Again, it's just getting your attention back at your food, rather than whatever else is going on. Eat at a moderate pace. That means not too slow, not too fast. Digest one meal before the next. It means waiting until your agnis, your digestive power, your appetite is giving you the signal again. Now, most human beings do better eating two or three meals a day. There are some people whose agnis are so strong that this grazing is beneficial for them. Women who are pregnant clearly should honor that appetite, and if they feel like eating every hour, they should eat every hour. But for the most part, the important thing is wait until you're really hungry. Don't just eat because it's time to eat. So if you ate a late lunch at 3 o'clock, you get home and it's 6 o'clock and your dinner's there, you're not hungry, wait until you're hungry before you eat that. Wait until your appetite gauge has dropped to a 2 or 3. Sip warm water. That's the preferred liquid rather than ice cold iced tea and things like that. Sips of hot water help to keep the digestive power going. Eat freshly cooked meals and minimize raw foods. Now, it's not that Ayurveda doesn't recognize that foods right off the vine are the richest in vitamins and minerals, but our ability to extract that information is very much dependent upon our digestive power. And cooking enhances our ability to digest. First of all, it makes it smell much better. So the difference between eating a raw carrot or eating some carrots that have been sautéed with some spices, you'll see that you'll start salivating. Your stomach enzymes will already start being secreted just from the smell of that, which cooking releases because cooking heats up those molecules. It makes the vitamins and minerals and nutrients more available to our physiology. That doesn't mean you never eat salads. It just means, for the most part, favor well, appropriately cooked food. That doesn't mean you cook it until it's in a pulp. It means cook it so that it's delicious, lightly steaming it, sautéing it, baking them in casseroles. Appropriately cooked foods. One of the first things that we invented as soon as we could figure it out was fire. It kept away animals and it made it so that food was much more delicious. So occasionally raw foods are fine, juicing is fine, but for the most part, favor freshly cooked foods. Don't cook with honey. It's in every Ayurvedic book. If you cook with honey, it will instantly turn into toxicity, and there's a strong recommendation not to cook with honey. Drink milk separately from meals. Okay. Ayurveda strongly believes in the nourishing value of milk. So let me talk to you about the Ayurvedic model. And again, if your body tells you that it's not right for you, honor your body. First of all, here's how we're supposed to treat our cows. They're supposed to be considered members of our family. They're supposed to hang out in our backyards and be fed beautiful, nourishing grains. We're supposed to go out them and pet them and talk to them on a regular basis. Play beautiful, Ayurvedically balancing music. Massage them daily. Treat them with total love and respect and appreciation. And then, when it's time to get our milk for the family for that day, first we bring in their calf and we let mom nuzzle the calf. And in her love for her calf, she has her letdown. And then we take what we need for the family and then we let the calf come in. So you could imagine that milk that was come to us from that process could be incredibly nourishing. It's the most nourishing thing that we could have because it does no harm whatsoever to the source. And even if you pull fruit off of the tree, there's some subtle negative karmic result. But this is actually a joy for the cow to provide us. Now, most dairies are just a little bit different than that these days. But it's shifting. It's shifting. You'll see in every grocery store now, at least in California, there are dairies that emphasize, we treat our cows with respect. We use no hormones in our cows. Of course, the FDA makes them say, just because we're using no hormones doesn't make it any better than those dairies that use hormones. We let our cows have regular exercise, good food, fresh sunlight every day. And it costs about 20 to 25% more. I would encourage you to spend the extra money to support that, because what will happen is if those dairies start to thrive, then the mainstream dairies will at least start to offer that as an option, because the market drives those forces. The other reason that milk seems to have a lot of problems in this society, not only because of the way that we treat cows, but the way that we take it. Most people drink milk right out of this refrigerator, and that increases all of its kapha aggravating qualities. Milk is kapha. I mean, it's cold, it's heavy, it's thick, it's oily. It's kapha, it's rasa in its nature. It's pure nourishment. But if we aggravate the effects of milk by drinking it right out of the refrigerator, it's going to increase those kapha aggravating aspects. More mucus, thickness, difficulty with digestion, heaviness, dullness. So that often we find that people who say, I can't tolerate milk, I have a milk allergy, by just changing the way that the milk is taken, having them take it separate from other meals, heating it, using some spices, ginger, cardamom, nutmeg. These are great spices to use in milk. If someone's having trouble sleeping because that vata is aggravated, one of the most effective things we can do is have that person prepare themselves a hot cup of milk, put some cardamom and nutmeg in it, which are both vata pacifying herbs. Drink it consciously, and the people who are having trouble getting to sleep will tell you that they'll fall asleep within 5 minutes. It's very vata pacifying. There are clearly some people who have lactose intolerance, that have the deficiency of lactase enzyme, and those people will have trouble with a lot of milk, although even now the American Dairy Association has done research to show that a little bit of milk can still be tolerated. Most people don't have a total absence of lactase. They just have a relative deficiency. And by preparing it in this way, almost everyone can tolerate and have the benefits of milk. It's great for vatas. It's good for pittas. For kaphas, you want to keep it pretty limited and usually favor the less fat modalities. If it doesn't feel good to you, don't drink milk. The most important thing regarding how do I keep track of all these different tastes is just be sure that all six of them are present at every meal. So at every meal, make certain that there's something sweet, sour, salty, pungent, bitter, and astringent. What might that look like? Well, let's say you're having Italian food that night. So the sweet taste would be the pasta and the bread. The sour taste would be the tomato sauce. The pungent taste might be the onions that you use to prepare the tomato sauce. Salty, obviously, you're going to have salty in it. The bitter taste is the salad or the spinach that you have going along with that. And the astringent taste might be the tea that you have afterwards. Or you have some wonderful lima bean soup, Italian style minestrone soup that goes along with it. So it shouldn't be complicated. Now, if you know that there's a tendency for one of your doshas to be out of balance, then you favor those flavors, those tastes that are more appropriate to balancing your nature. So that means if you're a kapha, then maybe you'll eat a little bit less of the pasta and the bread and more of the string beans and the salad. And if you're a vata, you'll eat more of the pasta and less of the salad. So you don't have to prepare three different meals for your family if you have a vata, pitta, kapha there. Prepare something that has all six tastes represented, and then you have people choose those which are most balancing. In most of the non-Western cultures, that's how food is served. So if you go to Korea, you'll see that the dinner consists of 10 or 15 little dishes of things, and then you take samples of everything. If you go to India, you'll be served a thali, where you have all different preparations there. So you can start thinking about just having a variety of these foods available, and then people choosing what they need to choose. Don't make it a compulsive ritual. Don't take the fun out of eating by worrying, oh my, I can't eat broccoli, I've got to eat cauliflower. You know, what happens when you're traveling? You can't have any impact upon what you're being served. You can certainly still have an impact on the consciousness in which you eat what you're served. You know, if my Aunt Goldie invited me over to dinner, and even though I'm vegetarian, she spent all day cooking me, you know, a chicken dinner, I would eat that chicken dinner, knowing that the love that she put into that probably far outweighed any of the negativity that I would normally associate with eating meat. So it's really our consciousness which is transforming that experience as much as whatever it is that we're putting into our awareness. So have six tastes represented. Don't eat to the bursting point. And then just spend a minute or two after the meal being aware of the experience. Again, it's a celebration. You know, most major rituals in most cultures are associated with some eating. So we eat at weddings, we eat at bar mitzvahs, we even eat at funerals, we eat at christenings. We eat at these rituals because food and celebration is really closely tied up. And it reminds us of how magical this whole universe is. So take the time before the meal. If you have a religious inclination, say a little grace. If not, just thank nature for providing you with this, just to get yourself centered. And then afterwards, spend a few minutes in silence, just letting your body absorb that information, that energy and intelligence.